Dr. Leslie Russell is a visiting fellow at the Australian Primary Healthcare Research Institute at the Australian National University in Canberra. This podcast accompanies a For Debate article Dr. Russell co-authored in this issue entitled Hospitals Should Be Exemplars of Healthy Workplaces. Today she's speaking with MJA Engagement Editor Kate Swanell. Thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
You've got a For Debate piece in our current issue of the NJA on healthy hospitals and why they should be healthier and why they're not and how they can be. What are Australian hospitals doing wrong?
I don't think we know the answer to that question, although in some of the states, I know in Victoria and New South Wales, some work has been done on that. But the case that we make is that hospitals are major employers. Mm-hmm. They hold a great position of trust in the community. Lots of people come to hospitals. They come as patients, inpatients and outpatients. They come as visitors. They come as people who work there. Yep. They come as people who train, are students there. And so the real opportunity is for them to lead by example. Hospitals and the people who work in them see through the illnesses that they treat the consequences of what we call the social determinants of health. Things like what happens with bad housing, poor environments, when there isn't transportation, poor nutrition, failure to tackle smoking, alcohol misuse, All of those sorts of things. And along with the almost miraculous work that they do in terms of treating illness, we argue that they should be in the role of promoting health and wellness amongst the community and in particular amongst the population that live and work there.
Because hospitals have a big influence on the community, don't they? They have
Absolutely.
A lot of respect.
A lot of trust.
Yep.
And a lot of opportunity, things that are teachable moments.
One of the themes in your piece is sustainability. I mean, hospitals suck up a lot of energy, don't they?
They suck up a huge amount of energy. Some of that, of course, is unavoidable because of the equipment that they use and the fact that they're operating 24/7. But it is clear from the work that's been, the audits that have been done, I mentioned before, in New South Wales and Victoria, but also in the United States and in the National Health Service, that there's enormous opportunities to make savings through addressing wastage in terms of energy consumption, but also in terms of sort of water usage and things like waste. There is a program that operates very effectively in Australia to address PVC waste, the bags that blood and saline come in, all that tubing, probably the rubber gloves, those sorts of things. But there's a lot of other packaging waste and so on that a little bit of thought, you don't have to save much of a percentage for it suddenly to make quite a lot of contribution in terms of dollars and in terms of what that means for the environment.
Obviously, new hospitals being built can build those greener options into their infrastructure. If I'm the general manager of a old established hospital, what are the things I can do?
I'm not sure that I'm in the position of being able to enunciate those as a list, but there certainly is some information coming forward, in particular from the United States, that shows that older buildings can make changes that make a difference. Yes, of course, it's much easier if you're starting from scratch, building a beautiful new hospital, like some of the ones we're seeing around Australia. But there is no excuse for people to say, well, our building isn't suitable to do these sorts of things. Every building is.
Yeah.
The experts are out there to tell the hospital managers how that can be done.
There's been a bit of controversy down here with one of the major hospitals having a McDonald's in its grounds or in its building. What about that issue? I mean, they've obviously got a partnership with McDonald's. The argument is they're providing cheap food for people who can't afford better. But what is the argument there in terms of not allowing that sort of stuff?
The issue really goes to what sort of examples hospitals should set. And it isn't just around food and it isn't just around fast food, although obviously that's important. Lots of people patients, visitors and workers get their meals, sometimes all of their meals, in a hospital. So it sets a tone. But it also goes to things like, what do hospitals allow in terms of smoking? What do hospitals do in terms of encouraging even things as simple as hand washing, which has also been quite controversial. So I think it's much harder for a hospital, and take for example an outpatient clinic that might be treating kids with obesity, to say here's the sort of foods you should eat more of and here are the sort of foods you should eat less of, mm-hmm. when the main foods that are available in the hospital are not nutritionally sound.
You spend a lot of time in the US. What's your impression been of Obamacare and the change it's brought about so far and how well it's going?
Look, I'm a big fan of Obamacare.
I thought you might.
And one of the things I say, it is certainly not a perfect law. It's got a lot of problems.
Yeah.
But one should never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And it's made an extraordinary difference. It is already making an extraordinary difference in a way that surprises many of us. I thought that we'd probably have to wait a decade or more before we started to see any impact. And already 4 and a bit years in, we are starting to see an impact. And I think there's even more of an impact if you look particularly, say, at the state of Massachusetts, which has effectively had Obamacare as Romneycare since 2006.
Yes.
They have got some so close to 100% of their coverage, of people covered. What that has meant is that you can already show fewer presentations at emergency departments, particularly mm-hmm. in lower socioeconomic areas, fewer preventable hospital admissions, and shorter lengths of stays in hospitals. Those are things that really start to add up. Mm. And across the nation, we're seeing a dramatic increase. There are fewer people uninsured in the United States than has been the case for 40 years. Healthcare costs are growing at a rate that is the slowest since they've ever been measured, since 1960. Maybe that's not all due to Obamacare, but a lot of it is due to Obamacare.
Yeah.
You're starting to see the uncompensated care that hospitals have was reduced by $7 billion last year. So everywhere you look, there are positive stories to tell. Suffice it to say, that has not stopped the Republicans from making their 53rd, 55th attack to repeal Obamacare. I would say that Americans themselves are not particularly enamoured of Obamacare. They do quite like the Affordable Care Act. But most of them like the provisions that they know about, even if they perhaps don't recognise that they're part of Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is going to be... I'm a little nervous about what the next Supreme Court decisions are going to be, are going to mean, but I think it's going to be very difficult to undo what's already been implemented. The other point I would make, though, is that the implacable Republican opposition to Obamacare has meant that no one has really been brave enough to go back in to try to make the necessary tinkering and changes to the legislation.
Yeah.
Now, when you do a big package of legislation like that, for example, in 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid was introduced, it does need constant fiddling with at the edges to make it work better. I mean, you can argue that that's been done every year with the US Medicare system since it was introduced.
Yeah.
And we've not really had that opportunity with Obamacare. And that really means that the system is not perhaps as good as it could be.
Mm. Is there anything we can cherry pick out of what's happened about Obamacare and personalised medicine and the Affordable Care Act? Is there anything we can cherry pick out of that we can use here?
There's a lot, actually. It's sort of surprising. We used to look at the United States as an example of how not to do things,
yeah.
and that's really no longer the case. in part because we're all dealing with the same sorts of problems, chronic illness, those sorts of things. I think there are probably two things that come to mind instantly. The first is the culture of innovation that Obamacare sets up through the Centre for Innovation at the Centres for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's looking at different ways of delivering and funding services, things like medical homes, accountable care organisations, many of which are even now starting to return benefits. Mm-hmm. And it means they don't happen as little isolated pilots that stop at the end of 3 years, that they continue and they apply as much to Medicare and Medicaid as they do to private health insurance funds. So I think that's a real approach that Australia should look at. Just having a culture, let a thousand flowers bloom, I suppose. The other is the approach to prevention, which sees prevention as a whole of government approach through the National Prevention Strategy and the National Prevention Council, which now has 22 federal agencies on board. So it says that prevention isn't just the responsibility of healthcare. It's about the Department of Housing, the Department of Transportation, the Environmental Protection Agency. What I really love about it is the action plans that they have, where you see three and sometimes four agencies working together, particularly at a local level, a community-based level, to address what the community needs are. That whole of government approach, what we call sometimes call health in all policies, the social determinants of health, it's totally recognised, and it's really starting to work. I mean, the obesity rate in the United States is pretty terrible, but as bad, Australia is almost as bad. But what you can see in the United States is that amongst kids, particularly low socioeconomic kids, it's starting to decline, and it's actually plateauing in adults. I'm sorry, but we can't say that in Australia.
No. When the last federal budget came out, there was general consternation about the lack of prevention strategies, and in fact the dialing back of many prevention agencies. And what's your feeling on the state of play here in terms of prevention of chronic diseases?
Look, I think there's a real dichotomy out there. I think everybody recognises that we've got to do more. But I think the federal leadership that's essential is not there because of a philosophy and ideology that says it's really up to the individual. I think there's certainly a role for individual responsibility in this, but people need help. They need guidance. They need to know what best practice is. And I think that the federal government is missing out on an opportunity that we will, and we'll all pay the price for that. There certainly are examples of where individual communities, I think there are some in Victoria where individual communities have taken up the cudgel and are working together and getting really good results. We need a lot more of that. And you know, if the only role the federal government played was to spread the stories about what works and what doesn't work, that in itself would be a service.
Do you have a take on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement?
Yes, but how long have you got to talk about it?
As long as you want. What are your concerns?
My concern is that the big pharma based in the United States are seeing the TPP as a chance to recoup what they saw as losses under the FTA, the Australian US FTA. They hated how that finally ended up, and they see the TPP as a chance to address that. And I think the USTR, which runs the negotiations in the United States, is in a very different place than the US Department of Health and Human Services on both this issue and on tobacco. And I think we just need to be very nervous about what provisions are likely to end up in the TPP that will impact on our healthcare system on, and on our public health initiatives like tobacco.
Yeah.
And that anxiety is compounded by the level of secrecy that pertains, particularly in Australia, but in the United States, about exactly what's being negotiated and how and why and when. It makes everybody unnecessarily worried.
Can you talk a little bit about the work you're doing at the moment at the ANU?
Jennifer Doggett and I have been doing some work on the impact of out-of-pocket costs.
Right.
We had a paper that we put out in January, a discussion paper. Interestingly, one of the things that we proposed was that there should be a review, an ongoing review of Medicare, of the MBS items and their reimbursements, because we see that it's not just as a delivering efficiency and quality and a more appropriate reimbursement for doctors, but also as a way of addressing out-of-pocket costs.
So you must be pretty happy with Susan Lay's.
I think the potential is terrific. I want to see action, like tomorrow.
yes.
And I want to see it done, you know, on the basis of evidence, with the right outcomes, with all the right people involved. And I don't want it to be just a one-off, but I think it should be something that's set up and permanently factored into the system.
It does seem to make sense to regularly monitor.
Of course.
What works and what doesn't.
You know, evidence changes, technologies change, science goes forward. The MBS needs to reflect that.
For sure. Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.